Thanks for those kind words. Alfred, thank you for those kind words. We're going to talk about this particular topic, taken from Titus 2, redeemed from all lawlessness, and talk about worldviews, legal rights, and wrongs. A number of years ago, a debate occurred at a venue called the Museum of Tolerance. Three guesses where that's located. Southern California, of course. The land of fruits and nuts, right? The Museum of Tolerance. And the debate there, I was a participant, the debate concerned, should we redefine marriage? That was the debate. My opponent was a Harvard Law graduate. He had formerly clerked for Justice Ginsburg at the Supreme Court. And we had this debate going back and forth at the Museum of Tolerance. Now, the Museum of Tolerance was established for a very good reason. It was to memorialize the Holocaust so that we can actually understand what can happen when things get out of hand. But now it's been overtaken by every Tom, Dick, and heretic, and every idea is over there. So that's the Museum of Tolerance. We finished debating, and someone asked a question of my opponent, said, David, you've talked about rights. You've demanded so-called marriage equality. You wanted rights. I have one question for you, David. What's the source of rights? David hemmed and hawed. And initially, he told us what was not the source of rights. It certainly couldn't be religion. Religion can have no part in defining legal parameters and duties. And then he went on and said, and by the way, morality can have no basis in the establishment, in the derivation of rights. So what is the source of rights, David said? The source of rights is the state. Now, me being a highly trained trial lawyer, stood up and said, David, I want you to be very careful of what you just told this audience at the Museum of Tolerance. It's in Beverly Hills, actually. Because what you just told these people is Nuremberg was wrong and Dachau was right. Because everything the Nazis did was legal. You could hear a pin drop in the Museum of Tolerance that particular evening. And I want to use that illustration to talk about the real issue that's lurking here in the course of that debate. The real issue is, who or what is God in the culture? That is, what is the higher or transcendental authority functioning or operating in the culture, and thereby impacting that culture's legal system and legal thinking. Now, why is that the key issue? Because law expresses lordship. Show me the operational law of a culture, and I can reverse engineer and show you what's driving that law, what is in fact functioning as the lord of that culture. Jonathan Burnside is a professor of law at the University of Bristol in the UK. In his magisterial book, God, Law, and Society, he says, law is a backstage pass to theology. Law is a backstage pass to theology. Now, why is that the case? That's the case because God made the world, there's an inescapable structure to real reality. We can't escape the way he designed the world. And the reality is that God is holy. That is to say, he is utterly other than the creation. There is a creator-creature distinction. The creator alone is independent. This is Paul's burden in Acts 17 when he's dealing at the Areopagus, right? He says, the God who made the world, there's the creation, creator component, and everything in it, being Lord of heaven and earth, does not live in temples made by man, nor is he served by human hands, as though he needed anything. He's independent, since he himself gives to all mankind life and breath and everything. Correlatively, the creation, including its positive law, the law enacted by the various governmental entities, the creation is therefore necessarily dependent structurally. Again, Paul makes this point in Acts 17. In him we live and move and have our being. We are depending. We must stand on something. And therefore, because the Creator alone is independent, independent and transcendent, his law will necessarily and properly be transcendent. It will be the law above the law, sometimes called the natural law, C.S. Lewis called it the Tao in describing it, and so forth. Now, when a culture, and thus a legal system, functionally reduces what is God in the culture, we can call that reductionism, the result is not that there's no God, small g, in the culture. The result is rather what functions as God will necessarily be found in the created order, in the creation, rejecting this law above the law. And given the design of the universe, that can't not be. There will always be a functional, transcendent authority functioning as Lord in that culture. In other words, when we reject the true and living God, creation becomes operationally transcendent. This explains why idolatry exists and also why it's so damaging to a culture. Now, this is a huge issue. This is an enduring issue to both Christians and to civilization. Early on, the church father Tertullian, who is reputedly a lawyer, emphasized this when he said this: the principal crime of the human race, the highest guilt charged upon the world, the whole procuring of the cause of judgment is idolatry. Now, particularly this idolatry exists fundamentally because this creator-creature distinction, God's holiness, has been breached and blurred. Now, I'm Italian, so, I mean, I like Italian meals. Italian meals are long, and they're good. They're long. Well, I like, when I do quotes, I like quotes. They're Italian quotes. They're long, but they're good. Now, listen to the way one theologian explains this. God accepts that humans have indeed breached the creator-creature distinction. Not that humans have become gods, but they have chosen to act as though they were, defining and deciding for themselves what they will regard as good and evil. Therein lies the root of all other forms of idolatry. We deify our own capacities and thereby make gods of ourselves and our choices and all their implications. At root, then, all idolatry is human rejection of the godness of God and the finality of God's moral authority. The fruit of that basic rebellion is to be seen in many other ways in which idolatry blurs the distinction between God and creation to the detriment of both. Well, that's kind of highfalutin theology, but this creates a very practical problem. One man put it this way. He said, without a transcendent basis from which to judge the decency of various competing civic ideals, there seems to be no reason other than preference to privilege liberal ideas over illiberal ideas. When he's talking about liberal there, he's talking about freedom-loving ideas versus coercive ideas. In other words, Nuremberg or Dachau, chocolate or vanilla, you know, ginger or Mary Jane, Coke or Pepsi. It doesn't matter. It's just a preference. That's what he's saying, unless you have a transcendent or a law above the law. Only God is transcendent, and therefore only His law, His order, can be truly transcendent. Accordingly, we see things in Scripture like this. All earthly authority is derived from above. Remember Jesus? He's confronting Pilate, right? John 19. You would have no authority if it had not been granted to you from above, you see. Jesus emphasizes the structure. Now, what happens in the modern day is that this idolatry affixes transcendence, this higher law idea, in basically two areas. One, what I call the idol of the state, the collective, or the idol of the self, the individual. And what's interesting, we see in law and public policy, modern thinkers, modern jurisprudence, has consciously rejected this notion of a divine transcendent. And thus they've embraced idolatry by default, if not by design. One man put it this way, a modern historian: no longer inhibited by the transcendental nonsense, notice the slurring rhetoric there, which has from time immemorial blinded lawyers to the function of law, we are for the first time, okay, danger zone should go off there. Notice the chronological snobbery here. We've got to figure it out, you idiots who went before, forget you. We are, for the first time, capable of using law to attain what? Justice? No. Socially determined ends. This is a radical redefinition of both the function of law and the source of law. But they've done it intentionally. This was a project that occurred. Now, when we embrace that sort of reductionism, when we abandon transcendence that is rooted in the Creator, we impact not only our personal space, but the public space as well. Idolatry will correlate to law. One example of this, we see in Scripture over and over the notion of giving over. God gives them over. And oftentimes there's things like famines, disasters, pestilence, disease, being conquered. But there are also giving overs that are beyond things like golden calves. Interesting passage in Ezekiel where we see this. Because they had not obeyed my rules, but had rejected my statutes and profaned my Sabbaths, and their eyes were set on their father's idols. Consequence, moreover, I gave them statutes that were not good and rules by which they could not have life. Unjust laws, laws that demote human flourishing, are a result of idolatry. We see this in Psalm 94, where the psalmist talks about the wicked ruler who does what? Frames injustice by statute. You know, statutes are to promote justice, but here we see the exact opposite, a leader framing injustice by statute. And I want to argue that that's a consequence of misplacing the higher standard, placing it where it ought not to be. Okay, that's the theory. That's the thesis. Now, what are the practical implications? Well, you can find the practical implications in almost any setting by asking a very simple question. By what standard? In other words, how do judges, how do legislators make decisions? Kind of an obvious kind of a question. Well, Benjamin Cardozo was a justice on the highest court in New York, that was called the Court of Appeals, and then subsequently the United States Supreme Court, well-regarded jurist. And he was asked the question, how should judges decide cases? And here's what he said. He says, what should guide the judges? He said, history or custom or social utility or some compelling sentiment of justice, or sometimes perhaps say, I love this one, semi-intuitive apprehension of the pervading spirit of the law, must come to the rescue of the anxious judge and tell him where to go. I would tell the judge where to go, but this is being recorded, isn't it? Isn't that interesting? This sounds a lot like where we got our so-called right of privacy that led to the destruction of 55 million Americans. Penumbras formed by emanation, said the court in 1965. As Justice Scalia sarcastically remarked, penumbras formed by emanations are more suitable for seances than for constitutional law. But there we have it. Is that a standard? Are any of those meaningful? No. No, it's just jumbled stuff. Now, given these things, there really is no standard. But the point is this, a strong connection exists between who is Lord, or what is Lord, and what is law. Law, as Aquinas said, argues and presupposes a lawgiver. The key question then is whether the law, which has sway in the culture, reflects this higher law that's also written on the heart. So it's higher law, it's transcendent, but it's written on the heart. It's close and knowable. Or whether it's an imposter functioning as that higher law. And what that tells us by implication is there can be no neutrality on this question of law and morality. There can be no neutrality. John Frame put it this way when he says, clearly it is wrong to say that God authorizes or approves the development of culture antagonistic to him, or even culture that claims neutrality. There is no neutrality. Either we do, everything we do is either for the glory of God or it is not. It either comes from the wisdom of God or the wisdom of the world. And these are antagonistic to one another. Unbelieving culture exists, and it exists by God's decree and permission, but not by his precept. He does not approve it. And thus, when we analyze these things, the real issue concerns the legitimacy of the law functioning in the culture. Put differently, the right theology matters to having the right law. This is and continues to be the story of the Western legal tradition, including up to the day in the United States. I'll give you an example. One watershed issue occurred in 313, the Edict of Milan. Constantine declared that Christianity, this is following his conversion, is no longer illegal. And there's a whole interesting story there. The Edict of Milan was actually done before 313, but it got published then and all kinds of stuff. The point here is that Christianity became legitimate in the public square. And this had a lot of reverberations, some of them we see today. It caused a paradigm shift to understand the role of how faith informs the public square. And what it granted immediately was liberty. Liberty to the conscience and liberty to the church for the first time in history. It also granted justice in the form of restitution because, of course, the Roman Empire had destroyed a lot of church things and stolen things and that sort of thing. We see echoes of this today. We see it, for example, in where I mentioned last night, how pharmacists can say, look, I don't want to dispense pills that cause the killing of innocent life. That's the liberty of conscience, first recognized legally here by Constantine. We see this in the tax exemption, the property tax exemption, and the donative exemptions for church and nonprofit kinds of entities. We see this for medical workers who want to opt out of abortion or what they would consider immoral kinds of artificial reproductive technology. So these things matter as they work their way out. Now, what's interesting is, after Constantine made this edict and the church didn't, you know, could kind of come out of the catacombs, as it were, they began wrestling with theological matters that matter, including who is this Jesus, because there was a lot of heresies that were brewing and so forth. But as an implication to these theological battles were implications dealing with socio-political matters, including checking the totalitarian state. Because remember, back in the Roman Empire, who was divine? Caesar was divine. And what was absolute? The Roman Empire was absolute. Well, now, with this idea there's a law above the law and there's a real Lord that's not Caesar, we have an issue. And part of the implications of these great debates was checking the power of the totalitarian state. Here's what I mean by that. See if I can distill this down. If man is created by God, then he is defined by God, and therefore he is a religious creature. And therefore the purpose of the state must be derived from that created reality. And what must that purpose be? To protect that which the Creator bestows. Okay? Laws, therefore, do not confer fundamental rights. The Constitution does not give you any rights. Rather, law protects that which the Creator has given. Now, if we were to describe that idea legally, it'd look like this. Here's Blackstone. The principal aim of society is to protect individuals in the enjoyment of those absolute rights which were vested in them by the immutable laws of nature. That's the legal theory. Now, if we're going to take that theory and put it in political lingo, it might look like this. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain, that means specific, unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men. Perfectly consistent with the premise, if man is created by God. Now, in contrast, if man is a political animal, and that's all he is, see Aristotle, then he is a creature of the state and nothing more. We saw this, too, parallel to the Revolutionary War, the War for Independence. We saw another revolution, the French Revolution, which is predicated upon Rousseau's thinking. It goes like this. The source of all sovereignty resides essentially, in its essence, in the nation. No group, no individual may exercise authority not emanating from it. Very different understanding of the purpose of the state. We see this idea going forward and accelerating. Alas, another Italian, but he explains it well, Mussolini. For the fascist, all is comprised in the state, and nothing spiritual or human exists, much less has any value outside the state. The fascist state, the unification and synthesis of every value. Now get this worldview language. Interprets develops and potentiates the whole life of the people. A very different understanding. And so worldviews implicate legal rights pretty clearly. If you look at the founding of the United States, for example, the Federalist, classic bit of political rhetoric and advocacy there, Federalist 51, one of the assumptions that streams all through the Federalist is the notion that man is a particular kind of creature that has a fixed nature. The idea of a fixed nature of what it means to be mankind is very scriptural. The nature of man in the Bible is deemed to be fixed and provides a platform for moral reasoning. For example, as to believers, James, we see this. Elijah was a man with a nature like ours. And then James goes on and makes an admonition to the people. But the predicate, the premise, the basis of his reasoning was that, hey, he's like us. He has a nature like ours. And therefore, we can reason morally from that premise. But that's against believers. What about unbelievers? I'm glad you asked. Acts 14, we see this argument being made. Men, why are you doing these things? So we have an inquiry, but it's also a moral evaluation. Why are you doing these things? Your ethics, your actions. I'm going to ask you a question about that. And he goes on to explain the presence here. We also are men of like nature with you. So this idea of a fixed human nature, it's a biblical notion. It has to be a biblical notion because there's a creature-creator distinction and so forth. We see the writers of Scripture using it, and we see some of the political philosophers adapting it. Now, untethered jurisprudence repudiates the notion that man has a fixed nature. One historian put it this way, where he says, this is Charles Murray, actually, who's a libertarian. He's not a Christian, but he has a moral thread running through him, and says this: the advocates of the welfare state in both Europe and the United States reject this view, substituting instead the belief that human nature can be changed. And he gives a classic example, the premise of Marxism. We're going to make the perfect citizen, the Soviet civitas kind of a deal. Well, this is exactly what happened in modern jurisprudence. Jonah Goldberg puts it this way when he says, it was their rejection of the natural law that Holmes and other historicist judges broke not only with the founding and Lincoln, but with the very notion that humans are creatures of a certain type, with transcendent purposes and ends that do not change with time. That's actually not Jonah Goldberg, but it is someone who said that. It's Brad Watson. Where does that lead? Well, denial of human nature as the mooring for equal rights, another man says, changes the purpose of government. When you change the subject of government, humans, you change the purpose of government as well. And then he goes on to say this leads to a redefinition of equality to be outcome, to be achieved by government through various and usually unequal means. That's very problematic. Because when we reject this notion, it undermines the notion of self-government. Okay, Locke put it this way, very influential in the founding. Thus, the law of nature stands as an eternal rule to all men, legislator as well as others. In other words, Obamacare should apply to Congress as well as the others. That's a nonpartisan announcement there. Just saying, Locke said it. Okay, the rule they make for other men's actions must be conformable to the law of nature, that is, to the will of God. And the fundamental law of nature being the preservation of mankind, no human sanction can be good or valid against it. So the legislator is to be answerable to this higher law, to pass positive laws that conform to this higher standard. Then we have this guy saying it. Alexander Hamilton. Good and wise men in all ages have embraced that the deity, from the relations we stand to himself and to each other, duty to God, duty to man, loving God, loving neighbor, has constituted an eternal and immutable law, which is indispensably obligatory upon all mankind prior to any human institution whatsoever. It's pre-political. The government doesn't create rights. The government, preserves and protects them. This is what is called the law of nature. Upon this law depend the natural rights of mankind. Hamilton wrote that when he was, you know, I hate this photograph because or portrait. He was 19 when he wrote that. So you young people, get at it. You got work to do. That's Hamilton's point. Now, why does all this kind of dusty stuff matter? So what? Right? Let me give you an example. Okay, so I talked about 313 in Milan. And I talked about that created all this dialogue and debate about the nature of Christ, who is the true Lord, and why that cabins off the power of the state, because Jesus is the one with the infinite power, and the state has derived power. Well, by about 383, given this Christian percolation in the Roman Empire, they allowed immigration, and that's actually a biblical concept, to allow people to come to areas that produce more liberty and opportunity, those sorts of things. And by 390, in the eastern part of the empire, there was an uprising in the city of Thessaloniki, Macedonia, now part of Greece, you know, Thessalonians, that whole deal. There was this uprising, and during that uprising, an officer of the Roman garrison was killed. Well, the emperor heard about this, Theodosius, and he does what Roman empires do. Well, what's the solution? You know, a coach, when something happens, the coach says, take a lap. Well, in Rome, if you're the emperor, if there's a problem, what do? Send in the army. So he did. He sent the Roman army to Thessaloniki. Because you don't mess with Rome, and you certainly don't touch, let alone kill, an officer in the Roman garrison. So they sent the army in, and the Roman army slaughtered 7,000 immigrants. Innocent. Took them out. Teach you guys a lesson, you barbarian immigrants. But one man saw this and was revulsed by it. One man said that, you know what? The emperor has a law above him too. And one man had the spine to approach the most powerful man in the world, Emperor Theodosius. And he went to him and said, most holy Theodosius, you know, as a Christian, the taking of one innocent life is a tragic and horrible thing. How much more is it wrong to take the innocent lives of 7,000? You must repent. You must do so publicly. And until you do, you may not come and worship the true and living God. You may not partake of the sacraments. And you know what? Theodosius repented publicly for this. Because one man stood in the gap. One man, as we talked about last night, saw truth stumbling in the public squares, and he didn't care about his own life because he was sold out to Jesus and said, you must repent, Emperor. That one man, of course, an Italian, Ambrose, and became later the teacher of Augustine. Pretty amazing situation. This stuff matters. We would have nothing to say to the Nazis or to the abortion regime if we didn't have this law above the law. The point here is there's no ruler who's above God and His law. And we have a prophetic duty to talk about that. Now, he could have got, you know, messed up. He could have got taken out. Look at John the Baptizer. Look what happened to him. He spoke against the rulers when he violated God's design for marriage and he lost his head. But he spoke prophetically to that ruler. Now, given this dynamic, you can see why the progressives like Oliver Wendell Holmes, the legal positivists and the legal realists wanted to gut natural law principles. Because if they can do that, they and their elitist friends become the lawgivers. And thus, they become like God. They do what's right in their own eyes. And ultimately, then, politics is all about power, not about justice. Here's Jonah Goldberg talking about it, describing this time and this transition in the law. It was time for man to lay aside the anachronisms of natural law, traditional religion, constitutional liberty, capitalism, and the like, and rise to the responsibility of remaking the world in his own image. God was long dead, and it was long overdue for men to take his place. He's describing what these people were doing. Well, and so what happens is, hey, it's legal, therefore it's right. That becomes things. And where does that lead us? Well, this is simply the incarnation of Hegel at that point, right? Hegel tells us the state is the actually existing realized moral life, the divine idea as it exists on earth, all worth which the human being possesses, all spiritual reality he possesses only through the state. That's not a good place to be. Benjamin Weicker comments on this and says, look, since they cannot allow a transcendent lawgiver, they seek an alternative source of the moral order. They attempt to ground morality in anything but God. I would say they're trying to ground it someplace in creation rather than in the Creator. Well, where does that lead? How's that working out very well? If not God, then what? Well, totalitarian sovereign, Hobbes. Oh, okay. Social agreement, the bad part of Locke, Rousseau, Hobbes. That's not Calvin and Hobbes, by the way. Pleasure and happiness, Bentham and Mill. Oh, okay. The stronger, Nietzsche, the will to power and all that. Tolerance, right? Tolerance. Again, I had the pleasure of being with Charles Krauthammer a week ago, and he said, what is liberalism? Liberalism is doing whatever you want as long as it's mandatory. Yeah, okay. There we are. This was the issue in contrasting the revolutions from America and France. A year, 100 years after the French Revolution, one of the parliamentarians lamented. He looked back over what had happened since the French Revolution. This is the time of Robespierre and the guillotine and whatnot. And here's his analysis. He said, the revolution puts the human reason as sovereign in the place of the law of God. From this flows all the rest, especially the pride and rebellion, which is the source of the modern state. The state has taken over everything. The state has become your God. He saw it very clearly. Again, we see the distinction then between that and the Declaration, which talks about a pre-political conference of rights, that man has rights by virtue of being man, by virtue of being human. And the governments are to protect those things and so forth. This battle continues on, though. In 1931, the Vatican issued a warning. It noticed that there was something it called state-olatry. That's a nice word, state-olatry, which was the statist effort in Europe. And what was that effort? 1931, this is pre-Hitler. It said this. That's Italian. If you can read it, you get extra bonus points. He says, this effort to monopolize completely the young from their tenderest years up to manhood and womanhood, see education mandate, for the exclusive advantage of a party and of a regime based on an ideology which clearly resolves itself into a real pagan worship of the state. This is the kind of stuff that's been happening over and over again. And again, as I mentioned last night, the state, with its political correctness and speech codes, is trying to catechize you to impose orthodoxy. And they may even have a formal catechism. Let's go over that formal catechism again, because you got to repeat catechism questions in order to get it. So, this is the church-state catechism. By who were you begotten? By the sovereign state. Why were you begotten? That I might know, love, and serve the sovereign state always. What is the sovereign state? Oh, the sovereign state is humanity in composite and perfect being. Why is the state supreme? Well, the state is supreme because it is my creator and conserver in which I am and move and have my being, and without which I am nothing. Well, then what is the individual? Very simply, the individual is only a part of the whole and made for the whole and finds him complete and perfect expression in the sovereign state. Individuals are made for cooperation only, like feet, like hands, like eyelids, like rows of upper and lower teeth. This is from a dystopian French novel, 1919. This guy got it exactly right. So this is where we're going, folks. Almost 100 years ago, he saw it very, very clearly. In this sense, Hitler was very French. Shortly after he was elected, 1933, in July, he said this. If anyone reproaches me and asks why I did not resort to the regular courts of justice, then all I can say is this. In this hour, I was responsible for the fate of the German people, and thereby I became the supreme judge of the German people. Everyone must know for all future time that if he raises his hand to strike the state, then certain death is his lot. It's all right there. That's what's going on over and over again. Lex rex, is the rule of law, or is it rex lex, the rule by law? We believe the rule of law. So the key inquiry here with this idolatry is, are man's rights granted by the permissive will of the state, Or are these rights inalienable? That is to say, bestowed and derived from the Lord God. But there's more in the story. There's an idolatry also expressed not only in the collective, this idolatry of the state, but also in the idolatry of the individual. It's an attractive idol, it's a powerful idol, and it's deeply influenced in Western law. I think it's the most influential one in our culture currently, and consequently the most influential in our law. One theologian describes it this way. I love this. Look at this guy. Yeah, man, here I am. I'm the king of everything. I'm the captain of my ship. Yeah. The fundamental idolatry described by the Bible lies also at the heart of the varied modern idolatries, the idolatry of the self. The self is set at the center of existence as a god. Ultimate significance is found in godlike individual autonomy, self-set goals, and boundaries. That's law language there, boundaries and those sorts of things. This is what the thing is. Now, a lot of consequences for what I call the idol of the state. If we were taking several weeks to expound this, I'd give you some of the theological errors that derive from this exaltation of the human will and the idolatry of the self. A lot of big words and all that sort of thing. But I want to talk more specifically about how this filters into the culture. There's a lot of ideas here, and they have consequences. It's the exaltation of the will and the supposed autonomy of the person. Last night I talked about Psalm 2. The rulers and the kings want to burst the bonds, cast off. That's an impulse toward this idea of self-law, self-economy. Man becomes the measure of all things. Man, not Scripture, becomes the canon. And so the merits of a particular act are simply whether they work. We become really pragmatic at that point, not whether it's right and that sort of thing. Let me give us examples. Now, this may seem a little archaic and strange. Let me just kind of put it down where we can all kind of grasp it here. Another Italian example. What can I say? There he is, chairman of the board. Frank Sinatra, right? What is his, after 1969, his Bring It Home song? What? Written by Paul Anka. I did it my way, right? Peter Kreef says the national anthem of hell is I did it my way. I mean, there we are. Man is the measure of all things. It's like Maximus the Confessor, another church father, put it this way. He said, Adam wanted to be God, but without God, before God, and not in accordance with God. I mean, other than that, there's no problem, right? So you see it like that. You also see this in conservative movements. Okay. I see this a lot of time with young people who are kind of enlightened and they're awakened, coming to their senses, and they all pass through what I call their Ayn Rand stage, right? So here she is. That's not her real name, of course. Man has to be man by choice. He has to hold his life as a value by choice. He has to learn to sustain it by choice. He has to discover the values it requires and practice his virtues by choice. Now, are we against making responsible moral choices? Heaven forbid. But now watch the twist here at the end. A code of values accepted by choice is the code of morality. Tilt. She worships herself at that point. Now, there's also goofy expressions of this, right? Let's put it in New Age terminology. Here she is. Warren Beatty's sister, Shirley MacLaine. Each soul is its own God. You must never worship anyone or anything other than self, for you are God. To love self is to love God. And if you need another reason not to watch Downton Abbey, I just gave you one right there. Sorry, you probably love that show. My wife loves the show. I don't watch it. As my 20-year-old son said, what's wrong with these people? Oh, okay, well, doesn't get the British thing very well. All right, so there we have that. Now, look what happens. Where does this lead? Well, the first of this year, about February, we saw this. Girl's going to auction off her virginity. This guy wanted to join in it, too. Look at the discrepancy in prices here. No egalitarianism there. She's $780,000. He's $3,000. Very interesting. And you know what she's going to do with the money? She's going to create houses for the homeless. you know, and probably free parakeets too or something. Unbelievable. But there were rules, mind you. Oh, there couldn't be drugs involved and no other. I mean, unbelievable. In the rejection of the created order, they want to impose rules. That's the idol of the self. The greatest damage, and I think Paul prefigures this, comes in this area of sexual behavior. Romans 1 tells us to expect that when there is an ultimate giving over, the most emblematic picture of this idolatry expresses itself in sexual behavior. Let me give you an example of this. Yet another Italian. Ugh, we're really taking it on the chin this morning, aren't we? Here's the beautiful Carla Bruni, who says, "Monogamy is terribly boring. I am faithful to myself. I am monogamous from time to time, but I prefer polygamy and polyandry." Now, this is an equal opportunity idol. You don't have to be rich and beautiful and famous to engage in it. Here's Ashley from Arizona State University, just down the street from me. "I am not a labelist, and I do not consider myself anything. I am simply open to love. I'm like anyone else in the sense that I am searching for the person who will make me the happiest and serve me the best. It just so happens it may be a guy or a girl." Why limit the possibilities? Who are you to reject half the human race? I mean, it's all about my fulfillment. You see what's driving this sort of thing? Now, what happens here is we have legal byproducts. Law follows culture. Law is a backstage pass to theology. And so we have things like no-fault divorce schemes, which is what? I got to be fulfilled. I got to do what's best for me. I've got to do what serves me best. We've codified that. And so we see an impulse in the law to recognize and codify this idol of self in the realm of sexual behavior. So the law increasingly codifies the sexuality of the self by using these assumptions. Now think about this. So sexual behavior is individualist. It's private. Consent's the only rule. Pleasure's the only purpose. And most people will nod their heads. Most confessing Christians will nod their heads. And the question is that true? I think the answer is no, it is not. Now, how does this all relate to law and culture? Well, again, I alluded to Romans chapter 1 a couple times. We see Paul concludes his argument there by saying that when this idolatrous worship of creation occurs, this reductionism, it ultimately creates an impulse not only to act in unrighteousness, but to approve that unrighteousness. Paul puts it this way. They know that God's decree that those who practice such things deserve to die. They not only do them, there's the practice, but give approval to those who approve them. And that's not only, I think, technical positive law, but approval in those icons of the culture that grant approval. Let me see how this works out. Stamp Corbin is the co-chair of the Obama National LGBT Leadership Council. He's a current San Diego commissioner. He recently said this: "The most insidious word that is constantly used in our movement is tolerance. I do not want to be tolerated. What I want, and I hope the LGBTQ community at large wants, is acceptance. That's right, approval and respect for my sexual orientation." Notice a shift in language here. Tolerance means we're going to, in an ordered society, allow you to do something that is essentially erroneous or wrong, but as the good of the order, we're going to allow you the liberty to do that. He doesn't want that because that includes an evaluative judgment that it's wrong. What he wants is to approve and to affirm these kinds of things. And this means that the left's operative goal is to eliminate rivals by precept, not by persuasion. Because to approve one thing in this context is to reject its opposite. And with respect to marriage and sexuality, what is being approved rejects what is right and what is righteous. And this leads to competing and contrasting models of what it means to be married and what marriage is. Tim Keller explains that this really originated in the Enlightenment. We didn't, you know, lose marriage, so to speak, or deform marriage in 1969 after the Stonewall riots. Was 69, 68 right in there? No, not at all. Keller says this. He said, "During the Enlightenment, things began to shift. The meaning of life came to be seen as the fruit of the freedom of the individual to choose the life that most fulfills him or her personally. Marriage is redefined as finding emotional and sexual fulfillment and self-actualization. In short, the Enlightenment privatized marriage, taking it out of the public sphere and redefined its purpose as individual gratification, not any broader good, such as reflecting God's nature, producing character, or raising children. That was the game. Thinking became corrupted. That led to practices becoming corrupted. And now the law is beginning to implement those things. And so when we talk about this marriage question, we need to ask, what do you mean by marriage and what is the meaning of marriage? We have competing models using Paul's language in Romans 1, where he says the truth is exchanged for the lie, Romans 1:25. We can analyze these competing models that we're seeing every day in the news and in the blogosphere. The truth is exchanged for the lie. What does that tell us about marriage then? Well, as to sexual expression and intimacy, the truth says that marriage between one man and one woman is the exclusive venue for sexual expression and intimacy. The lie says that's just one option among many. As to child rearing, the truth says that the optimal environment for rearing children is with their biological married moms and dads. The lie says it's a pluralistic, equal validity of all options. It doesn't really matter. Mothers are optional. Dads are optional. You can have three parents, right? We talked about that at breakfast. Societal nexus. The truth says that marriage is communitarian in focus. It benefits beyond the couple involved. And the lie says, if it even recognizes, it's mere companionship. As to sexual anthropology, the truth says that marriage is complementary. A male and a female come together in a unique, exclusive way that complements the two sexes. Well, the lie says it's egalitarian. It doesn't matter. It's like the Mr. Potato Head theory. You can put parts wherever you want to put parts. As to personal orientation, the truth says marriage is other-oriented. Okay? The lie says it's self-oriented. As to sexuality, the truth says that marriage is about sharing of oneself, including all that you can give, including your fertility. Well, the lie says it's all about self-fulfillment, baby. And when the fun meter goes off, I'm out of here. You see, the model drives the ethics that are going on here. Well, what's the relational expectation? Surprise, surprise. The truth says marriage is a for-life commitment. The lie says it's a for-the-moment choice. And so we've got this equivocation going on. What is it that you mean by marriage? And we need to understand those kinds of games as well. And the effect upon the culture and law involves a slow but progressive disintegration of the human person. If we define freedom as getting the outcomes we want, we will ultimately destroy society. That's the bottom line. Jennifer Roback Morris puts it this way. If we define freedom as getting the outcomes we want, we can't remain in the relationships and still be free. This definition of freedom places freedom and relationship in opposition to one another. It places a higher value on autonomy than on relationship. The only way to resolve the conflict between autonomy and relationship is to end the relationship. Look at the divorce rate. Thus does the definition of freedom as autonomy reinforce itself. Now, I don't want to get into this question of, and it's been a long, interesting issue, but I just want to note this. The Washington Post in 1931 noted that the Anglican Lambeth Conference allowed for the first time in Christian history, it authorized the use of contraception within the marital bounds. And here's what the Washington Post said about this. It said, carried to its logical conclusion, the Lambeth Committee's report, if carried into effect, would sound the death knell of marriage as a holy institution by establishing degrading practices which would encourage indiscriminate morality. These ideas get traction into the culture. This sort of thinking then leads to a culture of essentially choice. We see it here. Planned Parenthood. You know, they don't have Christmas cards, obviously, but they do have winter solstice greetings, and that's the message. Choice on earth. I would suggest that stems from an idolatrization of the self. Now, enter the law. This sort of thinking seeks justification in the law. Now, where do we get justification in our culture? A lot of places. One is the academy. Let's take Kinsey. Alfred Kinsey was trained at Harvard. He was a biologist. He was a Darwinian biologist. Then he started doing all these other things. What's the point there? His worldview was one of materialism. There was nothing above. There was just a flat idea of whatever is. Okay. So in other words, the academy declares that such practices are not simply okay, but they're normal. If they occur in the natural order, taking apart the fact that it's a fallen natural order, if they occur, they're okay. They're normal. He had what we call complete eminence in his ethic. There was no transcendental at all. The is becomes the ought. And yet, he was teaching in universities, approving all these deviant practices. Another area where we get approval is this notion of efficiency and technology. Science has become a lord of sorts. Classic example, in 1960, Margaret Sanger, the patron saint, or should we say the patron demon of Planned Parenthood, they still give their highest award in her name. She convinced the heiress of International Harvester to invest in the pharmaceutical industry to create the pill, Inovid. In 1960, it came to market and so forth. And that allowed for the first time, sex without procreation. It began to disintegrate the marital union in that way. Well, that's interesting. What was her end game, though? Why did she do this? What was her real motivation here? Well, she tells us, birth control is not contraception indiscriminately and thoughtlessly practiced. It means the release and cultivation of the better racial elements in our society and the gradual suppression, elimination, and eventual extirpation, uprooting of defective stocks, those human weeds which threaten the blooming of the finest flowers of American civilization. A lot of women were duped by this. This was a racist agenda from day one. Okay? Again, the point here is it's an idol of self that ultimately disintegrates what it means to be human. Well, of course, the law then catches up. We have Roe versus Wade, which I could give you the history up to it, but this is a very interesting idea here. What's the issue? The issue is the Texas law that banned abortions, except where the pregnancy posed a threat to human life. And so we get through this. They claim there's a right to privacy. This is the penumbras formed by emanations they used from an earlier case. Where does that right land? I don't know. First Amendment? No. Fourth and Fifth Amendments? No, I don't know. Ninth Amendment? Maybe. Emanation and penumbras of the Bill of Rights? Yeah, I guess. Implicit in the concept of ordered liberty. Really? What? It's gobbledygook. It's gobbledygook. And what's interesting there is it had a companion case. And what people don't understand is Roe versus Wade legitimized legal abortion from conception until birth. Okay, that was the law. People don't recognize that. Because the companion case dealt with the unanswered question. The unanswered question in Roe was this notion of health of the mother. Well, the companion case talks about this. We agree at the district court that the medical judgment may be exercised in the light of all factors, physical, emotional, psychological, familial, and the woman's age, relevant to the well-being of the patient. All these factors may relate to health. Now, notice the switch. This allows who? The mom? No, no, no. The power here is in the attending physician. It gives him the room he needs to make his best medical judgment. And it is room that operates for the benefit, not the disadvantage, of the pregnant woman. So who holds the power of abortion? It's not the woman's right to choose. It's the physician who makes the decision, okay, according to the United States Supreme Court. And this idea of a health exception. Well, what does that mean? What do you mean health? Well, notice it's all factors. This isn't preeclampsia. This isn't a blood clot. This is an ectopic pregnancy. This is whatever you want to know, whatever's well-being. Well, enter then what? The medical doctor holds the power here. Well, what happens if he or she doesn't know what they're talking about or has other motives, like this guy, Walter Hearn, who says, I will certify that any pregnancy is a threat to a woman's life and could cause grievous injury to her physical health. Abortion for any reason or no reason. Because the law set this up, this idea of the idol of choice. Now, what's interesting is that oftentimes you get a clear understanding that this thing is a house of cards. For example, Jeffrey Rosen, he writes for the New Republic, that's a left-leaning magazine founded by Herbert Crowley, a leader of the progressives, said that this pro-choice magazine was correct in 1973 when it criticized Roe on constitutional grounds. You're the progressive flagship, and you think it's wrong constitutionally. They love the decision. Or how about noted Harvard constitutional lawyer Lawrence Tribe? Behind its own verbal smokescreen, the substantive judgment on which Roe rests is nowhere to be found. They admit this, and yet they're driven by that idol that promises so much, the individual autonomy. It's interesting, this is true even in the face that the people who brought these two lawsuits have converted to Christ and hate their decision that bears their name. Norma McCorvey, Sandra Cano. They're both pro-life advocates now. And they can't get the court to change their rule. It's very interesting. Well, we had a chance to overrule Roe in 1992. 20 years later, the votes were in, and it was voted to be overruled after the conferences. This has been documented now, looking at papers and this and that and the other thing. But then there was a chat that occurred between Harry Blackmun and Anthony Kennedy. And the result was Justice Kennedy flipped his vote and reaffirmed the central holding of Roe using this language. Now notice, trying to keep these links together here, the idol of self. Here it is. At the heart of liberty is the right to define one's own concept of existence, of meaning, the universe, and the mystery of human life. Really, I'm Italian, so I think you should all kiss my shoes. I mean, really? I get to do that because the court... That is just a raw idol of self. Now, Justice Kennedy uses that same language when he knocks down the sodomy law of Texas. I got the right to define Lawrence versus Texas. He uses both of those cases to knock down the Defense of Marriage Act, the Heart of Liberty. These idols have destruction. Let me put it that way. What's going on there? So there we are. What are some other implications here? The theology of ethics. Well, one is euthanasia. Physicians-assisted suicide are right in this sweet spot here. The clone and kill research that we've heard about. This is just like in the Old Testament where we had the Baal worship and the cannibalization of people. You know, these people didn't die and then were eaten. They were killed in order to be consumed. That's exactly what's going on in our laboratories. Across the world, including in the United States, clone and kill research. We have a decriminalization of all sexual choices increasingly. You know that the polygamists are creating quite a stir now to legalize their choice because, after all, they have the right to define the universe. We're also seeing, there was an article in one of the most read legal blogs called The Volokh Conspiracy. Eugene Volokh is a libertarian. Sometimes he's really good, sometimes he's not. But there was a guest article there by a Northwestern professor that justified bestiality under constitutional answers. He said, look, animals are like sex toys. No big deal. They don't have to consent. And he made a constitutional argument for the legitimation of bestiality. I think it was kind of tongue-in-cheek, but that's one way to camouflage the real agenda going on there. This stuff has no borders if I get to decide whatever I want to decide. Now, ultimately what happens, of course, is, and it's got to happen by virtue of the logic, is sexual self-identification. We're seeing this increasingly now. Meet my friend. That's a female. Two different pictures of her, Shannon Minter. She, I guarantee you, has more understanding of Puritan literature than anyone in this room. Her PhD is from Cornell in Puritan English literature. She went to the University of Texas Law School, one of the top 10 law schools in the United States. She's a lawyer. I met her in 2004. We were having a debate. This is when Gavin Newsom was issuing all these fake marriage licenses and everyone wanted to talk and debate about these issues and all that sort of thing. We had a debate at a law school in San Francisco. It was a noontime debate. And there weren't security guards there. There were armed San Francisco policemen there. And they needed to be there. It was crazy. She was prepared, did a decent job. I did a decent job. She was cordial, professional, and that sort of thing. The crowd was another matter. And we finished, and it was probably 1:30 or so, and she goes, it's interesting. Notice in rejecting her femaleness, she uses cultural cues to reflect maleness. The hormones, the patterned baldness, the beard. She wears cowboy boots often. She throws her voice, hey, buddy. She uses kind of locker room kind of vernacular, how you doing, buddy? What's going on? To communicate, even though gender supposedly is completely fluid, but boy, she locks herself into stereotypical gender roles. It's very interesting. And she comes up to me and goes, hey, some of my friends are going to grab a late lunch. You want to come with us? My mind's going, Holy Spirit's going off, going, this is a test. You know, this is a test. I said, sure, let's go. So I go there, and she's there with a number of lesbian friends. They've got their kids climbing all over their laps. And we're just eating kind of delicately, not really talking about this issue and whatnot. Her cell phone rings, providence of God. And she comes back, and she's ashen-faced. She looks at me and says, well, I suppose you heard. I said, I don't know what you're talking about. What? Well, and we had filed an original action in the California Supreme Court to stop this madness. We'd asked for an extraordinary writ to stop the issuance of these things. She comes back, and it's March 19th, and she says, the court issued the writ stopping this. And then every eye was on me. What's the right-wing dumb fundamentalist guy going to do or say? Is he going to gloat, I told you, sodomy purveyors, that you were unrighteous. You know, this feels good. No, of course not. I said, well, you know, I'm delighted that the court did it. I think it's the right ruling. But we have a long way to go, don't we? Oh, yeah, yeah. Did you pass the butter? Okay. We just concluded the meal. They probably never saw someone like that do that. 1 month later, I'm in San Francisco. I used to live there. I never had seen this place before. And I walk and I see the National Center for Lesbian Rights, where she's one of the leading lawyers there. And I just, again, I felt prompted by the Holy Spirit. It's like, I wonder if Shannon Minter is there. So I go in there, knock. It was kind of like in those movies where that little slide door thing. Yes. There was a calorically challenged individual who answered the door. And it's like, oh, boy, what am I doing now? And said, yeah, is Shannon Minter around? Who? Jeffrey Ventrella. Just here. She said she'd see you. Okay, great. Hey, Jeffrey, buddy, what are you doing? Literally in the neighborhood. Oh, why are you here? I said, to say hi. Oh, well, have a seat. Have a seat. So, you really? I said, yeah. I was debating at another school. You know, the marriage question, surprise, surprise, you know, and there we're doing this and that. And, well, that's interesting. Boy, you guys are keeping us busy. Well, what'd you expect? I mean, you know, you're trying to change the course of Western civilization here. We're kind of going to try to stop that. You know, okay, I said, you know, I got to get going. I got to catch a shuttle. Got to get back. Thanks for coming in. My pleasure. Talk to you later. Oh, okay. I go back. I'm teaching at the Blackstone group and relaying this story, trying to show some things. And I have an email from Shannon. Hey, Jeffrey, my daughter and I are running in a half marathon in Alaska. Would you pray for us? Didn't ask for money. Didn't ask for a pledge. It wasn't a concealed fake thing. Absolutely. Let me know how it's going. That's a really important issue. We got, you know, cancer is striking, you know. Interesting. Find myself again in San Francisco. Subsequently, I can't remember the time. And I wonder if Shannon Minter's around. Hey, can I drop by and say hey? No, I'm just too busy. I got too much going on. Let's go to Jack London's. It's a famous San Francisco place. We'll go to lunch there. Now, I have a policy as a married man. I never eat with a woman who's not my wife. I figured it wasn't going to be an issue at this point. So we had lunch. We start talking. You know, our parents are God-fearing Republicans from Texas. We talk about this, talk about that. Talks about her family, her sisters, medical doctor, lesbian, you know. I said, where does she live? Oregon. I said, really? Where in Oregon? Oh, you never heard of it. I said, try me. Well, this place called Cornelius. I said, I'm going to be there in 2 weeks. Providence of God. Woo! You think I'd go talk to her? I mean, I know you, you know. She goes, oh, no, she's not ready for that. It's interesting. Subsequently, a couple years later, the group called the American Constitutional Society, which is neither, we're having a debate, five-person debate on marriage. One for marriage and four trying to redefine me. Who does Shannon call to come and into that rat's nest to debate? She calls me. Because she understands that though we fundamentally disagree, that I'm not going to be a rear end and deal with that. Here's the point. The gospel that we proclaim and believe tells us we are more like Shannon than we're not like Shannon. And if we don't get that, all the notion of reading books and being culturally engaged is rubbish, you see. We have the message of the gospel, we have the method of the gospel, and we must have the manner of the gospel as well. And we have to dialogue. How long? I don't know. I mean, Dr. Cornelius Van Til said, you got to be in a position to buy the next cup of coffee. You got to be in a position to buy the next cup of coffee. So you engage. You don't compromise one iota on the ethical issue. But you engage, and you talk, and you dwell with. You try to see. They're human, made in God's image. They are given over to idols, as you and I are, can be as well. And so we need to dwell with them and talk about that. So if you think about it, pray for that situation. A friend of mine saw her in an airport recently in D.C. and said hi. You know, we just try to keep those things up. She was in the photographer's case that I talked about last night on the other side. Horrible situation. But she's on the other side trying to be professional, that sort of thing. So where does this thinking lead, though, ultimately? And I'll close with this. 3 points. If we have this idol of self that we ask the state to codify, it'll lead to give us 3 things. One, tyranny of the judiciary. There's Justice Marshall. I do what I think is right and let the law catch up with me. You will have judicial tyranny if this thinking keeps going. You also have the idolization of the self, pretty obviously, which leads to nowhere. Nietzsche. The noble type of person feels that he determines value. He does not need anyone's approval. He judges what is harmful to me is harmful in itself. He knows that he is the one who gives honor to things in the first place. He creates values. He honors everything he sees in himself. This sort of morality is self-glorifying. Well, there you go. So it leads to judicial tyranny, the idolization of the self, which is nowhere. And ultimately it leads where? To death. Here's the one of the Pied Pipers of the so-called Death with Dignity, Jack Kevorkian. It's interesting. He says this. Those choosing to die would be free to change their minds. Of course, I believe in choice. But revocation must be limited, say to within 1 week of the scheduled date of execution, after which the initial assent must stand. Now, what's interesting is if you look at the data, people who have these horrible diseases that are terminal, oftentimes will have suicidal ideations. And what's interesting is they dissipate after a day or two. Notice what he says. Oh, no, within a week, you're dying. By George. Not by God, of course, because he denies God. He's an atheist. Isn't that interesting? The idol of self always worships on the altar of death. All those who hate me love death. And so when the law directs and controls the making, the faking, and the taking of life, liberty and law will stand compromised. When we abandon God, we will abandon man. That's what happens when we reduce and get rid of the law above the law. And that's the lesson we must embed in our thinking when it comes to worldviews, legal rights, and wrongs. Thank you for your very kind attention. We're taking a break now.